Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today we're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You can listen to the show live every Thursday at 11 a.m. on heritageradionetwork.org or download the podcast on iTunes. Today, my guest is Leah Ronen of Artisan Books. Leah has worked on the production of some of the lifestyle industry's biggest books, including the Domino book and Lucky Magazine's book. In addition to shepherding me through the process of my own book, Leah has been instrumental in her industry for identifying up-and-coming brands and companies that have had great books within them that have just yet to be written. Today, we're going to get to know Leah a little bit better and to get her insight into the world of lifestyle books, how the niche is doing in general, and the best way for someone out there looking to turn their passion into a book to get their ideas in print. So, Leah, hello. Thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So for people who aren't familiar with you, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the book world.
How did I get into the book world? I studied art history when I was in college and always loved the play of word and image and how those two forms went together. And, you know, there's very few things one can do with an art history degree. It was either I go to more school, which I really didn't want to do. I wasn't so good at it. Or you go to work in the art world in museums and galleries, and I wasn't interested in that. And so one of my internships in college was at Art News Magazine, where I got really excited about how do you just explain, what is the interaction between the two things, and how do you explain ideas using both text and image. So that really made me think very early on that books are what I wanted to do. And that they had to be visual books. I get really bored if it's more than a page of text. I've always been that way. I just can't make it through unless I'm reading a great piece of narrative fiction. So I knew actually right away that that's what I wanted to do. I started in art books and felt that that was pretty constraining, actually. It was basically producing monographs instead of helping people to do ideas. So I was so excited about the idea of doing a monograph of an artist for the first time, but in terms of book production, it wasn't that exciting. You're basically having a picture and then describing the picture in a caption, and then you're done. So then I went to work for a packager called Melcher Media, where I was for 11 years.
Tell people what a packager is. I didn't know about that until I met you. I think it's fascinating.
It's really fascinating. It's akin to being an independent producer in the movie industry. I think the best way to describe it is the kind of relationship that Miramax had. This is a relationship that people are familiar with, that Miramax had with Disney, which is you identify talent or ideas, or you come up with ideas on your own and you make a movie, but you get funded and distributed by a larger company like Disney. So in the case of Melcher Media, we would work in two ways. Either there were publishers who acted as the distributors and funders who would have a book already signed up, but they didn't have the means to produce it. They either had authors who required too much attention or ideas that were too complicated, and they needed a producer to make that book for them. Or we would come up with a book and say, God, you know, there's this great new magazine, Lucky, and we want to create this amazing style Bible that's never been done before. And we would come up with that idea and sell it like an agent and then produce it and then deliver finished printed books to the publisher that would then handle the marketing and distribution.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. Does that even exist anymore? Like, do packagers still exist in this kind of book economy?
They're having a hard time. They're really having a hard time. There's no area to have extra money built in for excellence, which is a huge issue.
Yeah, it's really sad to think about that, because I remember when I first heard what you had done before you were at Artisan, and I thought it was so fascinating that that existed as a thing, because I wish that that existed for every industry. If you had people who were just dedicated to like brilliant ideas and finding a way to bring them to life in the best possible version.
And I think the key actually is helping you translate what you do best. I mean, we as a packager, or what I did in a lot of lifestyle books, is worked with lots of people who were the best at what they did. So they were the best fashion designers, they were the best decorators, they were the best TV producers. And they had no idea how to translate that into a book. It's a very specific form. And so that's what we wanted to do, is to harness their talent and to pull out and explain ideas in the book medium, which is, I mean, you know, after having done your own book, it's not an easy process to do it well.
Exactly. So tell us a little bit about what your path was to artisan. How did you make the move from sort of packaging environment to artisan?
Yeah. I mean, you touched on it before that it was just getting really hard to package. Mm-hmm. Multimedia, I think, had a reputation for being very, very excellent, but also very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. And I think for good reason. It was a lot of work that went into these books. And there was a staff of me plus a bunch of other people who were working on books who were full-time employees for that book. But in the change of the industry, there was just no room anymore. And I started to recognize that there were so many books that I wanted to make that I would come up with ideas, and I was having such a hard time selling them because there was no fat anymore.
Yeah.
And suddenly I thought, wait a second, I can go work at a publisher and I can offer somebody money to make a book as an advance instead of them paying me to make that idea.
Yeah.
That's a great thing. So that was really it. And it's sort of while I was thinking that, I got a call from our publisher, Ann Bramson, who had been looking for, I think, somebody like me to fulfill mm-hmm. that role. And it was really kismet. It was just a really nice, it was a very nice and very instant fit. And artisan is exactly the kind of place that I wanted to be because I like to get my hands dirty in every part of the bookmaking process. It's important for me to be in a place that makes very few books at a time. You know, in order for a book to be successful, everything needs to work. The editorial, the design, the marketing, the printing, the production of it, how you get it out in the world. And we want to give that kind of attention to every one of the 12 books we publish a year.
So what is that process like now in terms of, you were talking about sort of, you came up with ideas for books and then mm-hmm. sort of found the right people to bring them to life. For people who aren't familiar with sort of the book world today, what percentage would you say, like an estimate, are books that are like you come up with ideas and then find people for versus people who are just like pitching directly at a publisher?
I think the majority of people are pitching directly at mm-hmm. a publisher. The book industry just isn't set up for that. I mean, we're, you know, most companies, Artisan is an unusual position. We're owned by Workman. Mm-hmm. We're an independent company. And we're not really driven by bottom lines. It doesn't mean that, of course, we need to make money and we yeah. run a very tight ship. But we don't have a made-up number that says you need to hit X amount of dollars every year and publish X amount of books. And that kind of pressure that the large houses feel, the big houses, means that people say, okay, I need to publish 15 books this year because I need to make X amount of dollars. And so they're just signing up whatever is coming in, and they're spending, I think, less time developing ideas mm-hmm. and thinking about what's right and just taking what's there. And they're overworked. They're publishing too many books. So it really works for them to work directly with an agent mm-hmm. who says, you know, I've developed this book project. I mean, in many ways, an agent does what I used to do as a packager.
Yeah.
Or they should do that. Mm-hmm. And many great ones do. They identify the talent, they go after them, they help them write their book proposal and tell them what will work and not work, and then present that to a publisher. So I would say that 95% of what's published is coming in through agencies.
Yeah.
I sometimes, like, people will, even when I get something from an agent, I love the opportunity to sort of step back and say, okay, you know, it's true, you've identified this really talented person who has something specific mm-hmm. to say, but the way that they've done it might not be the best form for what yeah. I think will be successful in a book. So sometimes we'll sign somebody up and then tear it apart and start yeah. from scratch, which is really fun. For me anyway, it might not be so fun for the author.
So you worked on two books that to sort of my world of geeky lifestyle people are Bibles. You worked on the Lucky Book mm-hmm. and you worked on the Domino Book. What were those processes like, and what did they teach you about how you would make books going forward? Because those were like category killers.
Yeah,
books.
They were category killers. I think that they, well, I guess I'll start with Lucky first because that was the first book. You know, Lucky Magazine came out, I think, in 2001 or 2002, and it just changed the way fashion magazines had been presented before. I mean, it was always sort of the Vogue model. Actually, the way interior designs books were, they were sort of monographs, and everything was big and beautiful,
yeah.
and you would have to look in the back of the magazine mm-hmm. for the credits. I mean, today,
I hate that.
It's crazy. I mean, in the blog world and in everything that's happening online, it's insane to imagine that you can't press the link that's just below the image to buy something, mm-hmm. but you know, there's still magazines that do this. The credits are in the back, and you're not meant to shop from it. It's meant yeah. to be editorial inspiration. So Lucky took its inspiration from the Japanese shopping magazine, so Kim France. Oh. That was sort of the major inspiration of it.
I never really connected that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Kim France, who was the founding editor, who's a genius, and her partner in crime, Andrea Lynette, who was the creative director, had been obsessed with these magazines over the years and thought, you know what, this is what we're going to do in America. This is what we need to do.
Yeah.
It's a magazine that you can actually shop from. So when that came out, I thought that they had, in seeing it, that they developed a new kind of visual language that I had never seen before. And in terms of fashion books, everything had just been these dull, super text-heavy mm-hmm. books. And I thought, is anybody ever going to learn to dress from this? Nobody
yeah.
will. Like, we need to be shown these examples. And I was finding, from my own personal curiosity, that I was learning so much from what Lucky was showing me about how to dress and how to put mm-hmm. outfits together, that I wanted to create that really in a book. And we sort of decided that it would be a Bible even before we knew what it was going to be. I remember talking to my production director and being like, it has to be really fat. It has to
yeah.
be at least 300 pages.
Yeah.
And it has to be this great size. I think I had actually based it on Arthur Elgort's Models Manual, or maybe it was even the Andre Balazs Hollywood book, but it was sort of this like very cool,
yeah.
you know, smaller size mm-hmm. that encouraged you to interact with it.
Yes.
And I think that hadn't really been done before. And I think we were one of the first people to use the FlexiBind format as well. And the idea was it has to be chic enough, but also useful. So
yes.
it's not as cheap as a paperback, but it's not as intimidating as a hardcover. Anyway, so we went about making this book, and we went to Andrea and Kim, and we got a great advance from this fantastic publisher, Bill Schenker at Gotham Books, who is sort of known in the industry and is taking chances on people. And he
yeah.
believed in the idea of doing a new fashion book. And it was really hard. It was a lot of work to put that together. It was something like, it was just thousands of pictures.
Oh, God.
And we sort of, you know, in many, many ways made it like a magazine. But even then, things weren't as swift as they are now. I
mm-hmm.
mean, the style director who was involved in the book was literally cutting out images from previous magazines and
oh
pasting them onto a piece of paper to make outfits. And then one of the people in our office would have to then, you know, go to the archives of Condé Nast to pull that single image into the layout.
Oh,
it was,
good Lord.
Yeah, it was really nuts. Anyway, but it was a lot of work and it was really worthwhile. And
yeah.
I think it sold, I don't know, like 150,000 copies.
Well, and it seems like that, and this is a word I've heard you use a lot before, it was like a recipe format.
Yes.
It was just sort of like this plus this
yes.
equals this
exactly.
format. And that's, I mean, even compared to today's blog world, it's at least closer to the idea of like immediacy and sort of like an instant learning.
Yes.
There's not a lot of text happening.
Yes. Yes.
It's a lot of like picture plus picture.
Yes.
And that's, to me, where the Domino book came in,
yep.
which is still a Bible to all of us who sort of love house stuff.
Yep.
Because it was the same sort of like recipe format.
It was. And Domino as a magazine really came out of the Lucky influence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it couldn't have existed before. And it was genius. I mean, it was this sort of this great democratization of design that none of us had seen before. You know, everything before then was El Decor and Veranda and oh. Town and Country. And it was these.
Sometimes
world.
I read Town and Country and I just
Can
look at it,
it
and I'm like, who reads this
I don't
magazine?
Know. It's crazy.
Do people buy things at this magazine? Like, if so, do they have someone who buys those things
right.
for them?
It's Charlotte from Sex and the
yes,
City, right?
Exactly.
It's the girls in pearls. So the idea that was, it was basically like, we're going to get rid of all of this and we're going to tell you that you too can have fabulous design at home. And so they stripped away with all the pretense and did exactly what Lucky did in magazine form. So it was a very natural next step to do the Domino book. I think Condé Nast really wanted it, and I think the editors at Domino really wanted it. And again, it was just a lot of work. It was really hard to get the right tone and the right mode of expression inside and to make it as Bible size as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really ushered in, when I think about it, the books that came after Domino, it ushered in an era of something for everyone
yeah.
in terms of design. You know, previous to that, the design books were super specific. It was like how to decorate in Italian rustic style or
yes.
how to live in white and all these things that made no sense for the
yeah.
majority of people. And then this came and it was, you can find yourself anywhere here, whether you're a bohemian chic, whether you tend more to European Louis Quinze
mm-hmm.
chairs.
I feel like they ushered in an era of like, I'm going to give myself a very specific name for my style.
Yes.
It would always have all these words you could kind of like
put
plug
together.
And play
yes.
together
yes.
to make different things.
Yeah.
And I feel like it also kind of re-ushered in the idea of like the book as the object.
Totally.
Because that is a book that for me was so revolutionary because it didn't have a picture of a room on the cover, which is such a like given with a home book, is that there's going to be a gorgeous bedroom or a gorgeous living room. And it was just that really awesome chinoiserie wallpaper.
Yeah, it was.
And people still want to use that wallpaper just because it was on the cover.
I agree. And you know, it was such a moment. The publisher who published that book, Simon and Schuster, they said, you know, what are you talking about? Give us a great living room. And it was a real,
that's
what they wanted on the cover, of course. And it was a real fight. I mean, we felt that when we looked at what Domino had done, I mean, those editors, Deb Needleman and Sarah Costello and Derek Caponegro, they were geniuses in everything that they did. And one of the things that Domino, I think, really ushered back was wallpaper. Mm-hmm. That people hadn't, they had assumed that it was this dowdy grandmother thing. And then every other person was talking about de Gournay this, de Gournay that. And that's what we realized, that this was about creating a book that hinted at a sensibility instead of telling you too much. And so we went to de Gournay to slightly change the color of the wallpaper that they had done there, and found a way to actually create a finish on the book that made it feel a little bit like wallpaper. It's slightly textured, and it's nice and thick, and it just feels super satisfying. And I think that was it was a real moment and a really exciting one.
I love it. It's one that's lasted for a while. I have a bajillion things I want to ask you. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to jump back in.
Thanks.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hey, welcome back to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today I'm speaking with Leah Ronen of Artisan Books. Before the break, we were talking about her experience with some major category killer books like The Domino Book and Lucky Magazine, but I want to sort of jump forward to what's happening with today's book world, because that seems like light years away.
It does.
I remember
like
when I was
away.
Doing my book with you 3 years ago now, and we talked about The Domino being sort of like a good reference point for that. And it was like, well, that sold 100,000 copies, but that was years ago. And that will not happen anymore. Do not get your hopes up. It's a very different book community. What do you think is expected of today's authors and sort of a tough economy, not just for books, but sort of all publishing?
Yeah, a lot is expected of today's authors. Boy, this is such a complicated, subject. I mean, publishing is undergoing, as everybody has heard, just a really, really, really tough time. And I think that the toughest problem that we've had is, of course, the loss of a bookstore. That was our most natural way to market a book and to just have that amazing sense of discoverability, which was really important in design books and in any coffee table book or where the object is important. You know, when Borders closed, that was 30% of our business just disappeared. It didn't go anywhere else. It was just gone. And now, you know, there are communities that you go to where people say, like, I literally don't have a bookstore within miles and miles and miles. So that means that in order to hear about a book, they need to hear about it from somebody else and then to go online and buy it. So that's either through media or through radio or through a blog. Because our most traditional marketing tool had been the bookstore itself, it means that we're relying much more on authors to market their books. So people want to work with people who have outlets of information. You know, that's really the reason why we're always saying, you hear publishers saying, you know, we're looking for people with platforms. We're looking for people with platforms. And it's just because we need help in getting the word out. It's now a much, much smaller space. You know, I like to say oftentimes when talking about this, that when you're publishing online, you know, there's nobody telling you no, there's no barricades anywhere. You can literally, I don't know how you do it because since I don't publish online, but I imagine you like press a button and it gets sent, this information gets somewhere.
That's literally what happens.
And you're just suddenly published. And in book publishing, there's a million barricades. There's all these people giving you their opinions and saying, no, I don't like this cover. If you want to do this, and it has to be that, and this is what it's going to cost. And it's a very, very limited shelf space. If you go into an average bookstore, when we're talking about design books or lifestyle books, it's six books that they have space for.
Yes.
So they better be really, really great ones.
The other hard thing that we ran into, especially, was that blogs in particular are so used to, I mean, there are plenty of niche blogs, but they're used to covering like such a wide range of topics.
Yeah,
that if you're a home blog, you talk about DIY, you talk about kitchen, you talk about what you wear in the kitchen, and those are all different sections of a bookstore.
That's exactly right.
And that was like the big thing to me, was I was like, oh God, you have to really kind of like condense what you talk about into a topic that works for a book.
Yes, that's very right. We often get proposals. Very often will people say this is a lifestyle book, and there is no lifestyle category in book publishing.
Yeah. Do you think there will be one day? Do you think there will be a world where bookstores have like a lifestyle section?
I don't actually. I think that lifestyle books will live in other stores. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's one of the shifts that we're seeing happening, is that the kind of consumers that we're going after, unfortunately, don't spend a lot of time in bookstores anymore because they don't exist. They want to. They especially want to be in independent spaces, but they're not there for them. So one of the things that we and many publishers are trying to do is to sell books into spaces where we think people like you are hanging out. So whether that's a West Elm or an Anthropology or gift stores, where you happen to be buying candles, and suddenly there will be a book on candles there with you. So that's a whole new strategy. That it's a growing sector for us, and one that's very, very important.
Has that shaped sort of book pitches or the types of books that get made now? I mean, that was a big player, is like Anthropology, Urban Outfitters, Target, West Elm, and they sell large quantities of books because they're almost sold as an object, which I know to some publishers is kind of heartbreaking because people may not actually be cracking the book open.
Yes.
But it's like an object that matches a color
palette. I agree.
And
people love to decorate with books more than using them. I mean, I think a lot of people still decorate with books. I mean, they love to have that as part of their home and use them as things. Look, Anthropology, when a book is done right, is making enormous buys.
Yeah.
I mean, much, much bigger than, you know, in the old days, in the Domino days in 2007 or 2008, when that book came out, a big buy from Barnes & Noble would have been 20,000 copies.
Yeah.
Now, if they order 4,000 copies, we're in heaven. I mean, it's sort of unheard of. That's a huge shift.
Yeah.
A big buy from Anthropology can match that now. They can come in at 5,000 copies, which is tremendous. So it's a struggle. I mean, we want to do whatever we can to support bookstores. I mean, I think that's the most important thing of all. It's a key to the survival of our industry, for people to be able to go into a space and just say, oh my God, look at this book. This is what this is. I never imagined it. Hopefully that's the reaction you have when you see these books. But we certainly need to be partnering with these other companies who are probably more adept at this point at getting the word out.
That's one thing I wanted to ask you about, that I think people listening who, if they've been interested in making their own book in the lifestyle niche, should they be thinking about those tie-ins when they're pitching a book? Like, should they be thinking about, this is something that would fit in well with a larger brand like Anthropology or whatever, because XYZ? Should they be tailoring pitches to fit a larger market like that?
I think that's a little extreme. I mean, it's yes and no. I think that they... probably they're in that space already anyway. Probably their ideas are in there anyway if they're lifestyle books. I think, you know, authenticity and specificity of voice are always important. So, I mean, we were talking about this beforehand in terms of advertising on blogging. I mean, people can smell stuff from a mile away.
Yeah.
And for us, the people that we're interested in are ones who have a new idea to share, a specific point of view, and in-depth knowledge about a specific subject. I think what they should really be doing is picking a specific subject. Like you said, on these blogs, you're doing everything. You're playing with balloons. You're cooking a dinner party. You're, you know, stacking books on your table. And a book, you know, needs to be more in-depth. It's not a blog. It's a lot of pages of very serious information. And in order for it to have a long life, it needs to have something significant to say. So I think the best advice I could give people is really think about that. You know, what are you in the position to say that other people can't say, either because of knowledge that you might have, like Amy with her decorative arts history degree is immense. I mean, that's information that you just can't pick up anywhere else. There's real value in imparting that kind of information. And those are the kind of books that will last over time. So I think it's more about specificity of idea. And then a publisher can help you tailor it to those markets by what your book cover looks like or what the design of the book looks like. I think Anthro is more interested in that than what's on the inside. Oh, yeah. Sometimes
there are always lots of conversations about, like, does that book cover fit that the palette that's going to be popular in the store at that time of year, which sometimes you luck out about, and sometimes it's a very different color
palette.
I'm really curious about niche books. I mean, obviously we're talking about lifestyle, it's already kind of nichey, but I feel like when I go to a store, there are two very specific type of lifestyle books. There's like the Martha Stewart Encyclopedia of Sewing,
yes,
which is amazing, and I shell out for books like that.
Yes.
And then there are books that are like 10 projects that just use Easter eggs.
Yeah.
And it's something really, really specific, but they both seem to be there.
Yeah.
Is the market sort of swinging in both those pendulums at the same, or both ends of the pendulum at the same time? Or do you see one of those sort of being more popular than the other?
I mean, I'll tell you what I'm interested in, which is, I think that the Martha Stewart is a great example because it's still a specific subject, but it's the Bible of that subject.
Yes.
That, I think, is the key to have. I mean, one of the things that we saw, you know, with your book, with the Domina book, with the Decorate book, was there was specificity of subject because it came from a specific point of view, and it was about decorating, but it really was a something for everyone. So I think we're now going to, we've all published that very well now, and I think that's going to end. So we are shifting to something that's more specific, decorating with flowers, for example, or projects to make with a specific kind of material, for example, like 110 things you can build with wood. I really happen to like the number 100. I think it's just a really good one. So to me, if it's specific but very large, that's the best combination.
See, I feel like that's a blog influence. I don't know if that's true or not, but I feel like the longer I've been blogging, the more I feel pressure to number things. The top 20 wallpaper sources, the 50 resources you need to have no matter what.
And I feel think like you get that from magazines, probably.
It could be. And it's, well, now I feel like the way Pinterest has affected things, it needs to be this list that like pulls people in, and numbers do that more than the phrase like my favorite. I think if it's like my favorite 25 blah blah blah, it does a lot better than something else.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, magazine publishers would always insist that people have numbers on the covers of their magazines. One of the first books that I edited early on in my career was a history of the National Enquirer, and it happened to be, it was an amazing book. It happened to be the 30th anniversary of National Enquirer, and it was under an imprint produced by Miramax. I'll never forget the publisher saying, well, this is a magazine, like, even though it's a book, put the 30 years on there. And I was like, 30 years of the National Enquirer just sounds so wishy-washy.
Yeah.
Like, if it was 50 or 75.
Yeah.
But he insisted that the number go on there. And I think that that came initially from magazines. And yes, it's true from blogs. I mean, we all take from each other constantly.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, what I want to know a little bit more about sort of what publishers are looking for in a pitch from people these days.
Yeah.
Because I feel like bloggers are constantly pitching, and there are lots of different theories about the best way to do it. What are some pitfalls that people should avoid when pitching?
What are some pitfalls?
Like, what are things you get something on your desk?
I mean, something I hear all the time is Grace Bonney's Design Sponge did, you know, A, B, C, and D, and this will be like that. And I just think, no, because I want you to do something that you've done. You know, over and over again, we hear Grace Bonney did this, Holly Becker did that, and okay, that's great. They did that. You know, what are you going to offer? So we don't need that kind of context. We know what the context is. I would say spend less time giving us the context of the environment and more time telling us, you know, what you can do. So I think being in depth about it, showing how it can last over a period of time, you know, any good agent will tell you the sample chapters, a detailed outline, showing how an idea can be carried throughout. If you have any kind of design sensibility or ability to design pages, I think that's often very helpful. There are a lot of editors who just can't make that leap, I think, and they don't get to that point until they are working with their own designers. So if you think that there's something unique about the presentation of your idea, I would mock that up. I think that that's always a, seeing something visual is really helpful.
Yeah.
And then, of course, talking about your own marketing partners, as we've talked about, if you happen to already be designing a line of cards that are sold at a certain place, that's very helpful for somebody to know.
I'm curious about book tours as well.
Yeah.
I did a rather lengthy one, and and I feel like a lot of people are doing actual tours now, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah.
Are they sort of a thing of the past? Are they coming back? Or do you think this sort of digital version of what people call like a blog tour, is that sort of the future of book tours?
We at Artisan, as part of Workman, are very unusual in this case. We still really believe in the book tour. There are very, very few publishers who are doing it. And, you know, they're probably right in that it's really hard to justify the return. It's enormously expensive.
Yeah.
You know, every city costs us $2,500, whatever it is, $3,000. We have always, from the founder of our company, Peter Workman, just really had this belief in getting out there and meeting people. And I love that. I just think it's really important. I think that your book, you know, one of the things that's amazing about making a book, if you're a blogger or if you have another business, is that this is your portfolio. This is your calling card. You know, people, you can use the book as a marketing tool to get into, have new relationships with advertisers or promotions or magazines. Like you'll be, it's a tool to be covered in a way that you haven't been covered mm-hmm. before. And to, I think, increase your audience. I mean, if you're wherever you are in your business, whatever kind of growth you want to experience, a book is a great way to do that. And the best way to do that is to just get on the road and meet people. But it's exhausting and it's a ton of work and it's often demoralizing. You know, you know how many people come to your site every day and you expect that, you know, thousands of people will be knocking down your door at events. And sometimes that's not the case. So we're very careful about where we tour. I think that the kinds of, places in which we host people are exceedingly important. Unfortunately, you know, bookstore is not the right place probably for somebody in the design space, but they're really great for somebody who's just published the next great work of fiction or narrative mm-hmm. nonfiction. So finding the right outlets to have those tour events, and working very, very closely with those outlets to tailor them specifically is of the utmost importance.
We're almost out of time, so I want to end with sort of a forward-looking question. What are sort of the books that you see coming up or in the market that have just hit shelves that you think are sort of the most innovative that people should be looking to as examples of what they should be striving for?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. Can I talk about one of my own books coming out?
Yeah, of course.
We've just published a book called The Flower Recipe Book. You hinted at this before. Something that we're really thinking about a lot at Artisan is, you know, we like to say we're not a coffee table book company. We're the intersection of beautiful and useful. And we're trying very, very hard to make books that have something significant and new to contribute. Flower arranging has been back in a big way for a long time. You know, all of these things are cyclical in lifestyle.
Yeah,
it's amazing
absolutely.
To see them happen every 10 years. Something comes back again, whether it's in entertaining or in designing or in flower arranging. And we really want to find the people who are best doing the most interesting work of that. So these lovely women, Jill and Alethea of Studio Chu, just make the most exquisite arrangements. And they've created this book that we're publishing this month called The Flower Recipe Book. And it's flower arranging written as if it's a food recipe. So again, just that idea of we're going to take all the bullshit away from you. It'll be beautiful in the presentation of the mm-hmm. images, but we're going to tell you exactly how to do it. And I think that that's what we need to be doing as publishers. We need to be giving value that you just cannot have online. I mean, that's the only way our industry is going to survive is if we harness the book form in its best ways. Like, we need to use the book, the production of the book, the design of the book, the editorial of the book, just the sheer breadth of a book, the fact mm-hmm. that it's 300 pages of content. I mean, 300 pages as opposed to scrolling down five pages.
Exactly.
It should really say something in those 300 pages. It needs to be a value. We're asking people to spend $25, $30, $35, $40, $50 when they're used to just now looking anything up
endless
online
free
for
content,
free.
Yeah.
Endless free content, which is, it's crazy. It's really, really crazy. So I think it's just getting some rigor back is really the goal, is, you know, identifying people who are doing really unusual things in any category and helping them best express their voice in a form that is unique to the book. And that's the only way books are going to survive. They need to have a reason to exist.
That's a great note to end on. And it's so inspiring to think about anybody who wants to do a book out there to really remember the importance of that intersection between what's beautiful and lovely and pinnable and all that good stuff,
yeah.
but what's also functional or
right.
will actually inspire somebody to shell out and invest in something that they're going to continue to open and use for years and years and years to come.
Exactly. That's the hope.
Thank you so much for all your insight today, Leah. For any of you
Thanks,
interested,
Grace.
You can visit Leah and Artisan Books at workman.com/artisanbooks and on Twitter at Leah Ronan.
Or at Artisan Books.
Or at artisanbooks.com. Mm-hmm. Thanks for being here, Leah. And thanks
Grace.
To everybody for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.